Good evening and welcome to another edition of A Critical Ear here on WRFU LP Urbana 104.5 FM. We're doing a slightly pre-recorded show. We're recording this early Thursday morning for broadcast, of course, today, the 27th of November 2008, starting as we usually do with an edition of the Panos News Bulletin for today, the 27th of November. Indian police have besieged Mumbai hotels in a battle to release hostages a day after terrorists attacked and killed 101 people. Some hostages have been freed, but blasts continue to be heard at three sites, including two luxury hotels. The gunmen targeted at least 10 locations popular with tourists within India's financial capital during the highly coordinated attacks on Wednesday night. A little-known group calling itself the Deccan Mujahideen has claimed responsibility. Gunmen invaded two five-star hotels, a popular restaurant, a crowded train station, a Jewish center, and at least five other sites armed with assault rifles, hand grenades, and explosives. India's Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has vowed to take whatever measures are necessary to track down those responsible for the attacks. Teething syrup tainted with a toxic thickening agent has killed 25 children in Nigeria. The syrup, called My Pikin, had been tainted with diethylene glycol. It has been removed from shelves and the Lagos-based manufacturer shut down. The National Agency for Food, Drug Administration and Control said the dead children were aged between 3 months and 4 years. They all suffered kidney failure. In addition to the deaths, 11 children are being treated after ingesting the syrup meant to soothe a teething infant's sore gums. A new study says young people are more likely to be murdered in Latin America than anywhere else in the world. The study by a Brazilian research group shows that the region has the highest murder rates in the world for people aged between 15 and 24. Using data from 83 countries, the research group found the probability of a young person being murdered in Latin America is 30 times higher than in Europe. El Salvador and Colombia topped the list of the most dangerous countries for young people, while Chile and Cuba were the least. The study, called Map of Violence, The Young People of Latin America, was compiled by researchers at the Latin American Technological Information Network in RITLA. Mentally disabled women are increasingly being deployed as suicide bombers in Iraq. The latest struck on Monday, killing five people just outside the highly fortified Green Zone. Officials said her explosives vest was triggered by remote control. The most prominent example of the tactic was the deployment of mentally disabled female bombers last February at a Baghdad market when 99 people were killed. Insurgents are also using female suicide bombers to avoid detection at US-Iraqi military checkpoints. Iraqi women are often allowed to pass through checkpoints being guarded by males without being searched. Three female politicians have scored a first in Ghana. The women have been chosen to represent their parties in the vice presidential election in 2 weeks' time. Gender activists have warmly welcomed the development, although the parties fielding the female candidates have only slim chances of winning. They will be representing small parties with little hope of taking the second highest office. The three leading political parties, the ruling New Patriotic Party, the National Democratic Congress, and the Convention People's Party, had considered female candidates for the vice presidential position, but in the end stuck with men. In Ghana, 11% of parliamentary seats and just fewer than 16% of ministerial posts are held by women. Hundreds of internet cafes are to be closed in the South American country of Guyana. The government has accused the cafes of bypassing the telephone company system to offer cheap international calls. The revenue authority said the cafes were evading paying taxes because they did not charge sales tax or other fees for calls made through internet-based phone services like Skype, Vonage, and Packet 8. The threat of closure comes at a time when cafes were mushrooming in the country. Callers who use phone companies, Digicel and the Guyana Telephone and Telegraph Company, account for 16% of the country's sales tax revenues. Several countries have blocked or stifled phone calls through the internet. And that was the Panos London News Bulletin for today, the 27th of December, or of November, rather. The Panos News Bulletin comes from the Panos Institute in London. And we'll start now our discussion with Bob Naiman with us as usual. Good afternoon, Bob.
Good afternoon, Andrew.
And first, big news today. We've been covering for quite some time the negotiation of the security agreement between the United States and Iraq. Today, the Iraqi Congress or the Iraqi Parliament decided to pass and approve of that draft agreement.
Yes, and one can say that in a short-term sense, at least, it's a victory for the Iraqi government and for the U.S. administration, which lobbied for this agreement very aggressively. And also, not just the fact that it was approved by the parliament, but that it was not a narrow result, one can say. Of those voting, of those who were present for the session, 75% voted yes, and was something. The yes votes were something like 55% of the overall seats in the parliament, and of those voting no, it was the 30 parliamentarians representing the Sadrist bloc and five others. So they did succeed in the goal that the Iraqi government had set, of not just having a narrow majority, but trying to have broader support for the agreement, as they had promised Ayatollah Sistani they would do. He said he would only support the agreement if they got an Iraqi national consensus. And in order to achieve that result, they had to do some last-minute negotiations with some of the Sunni parliamentarians, who managed to extract a commitment, which was part of the package that they passed, that there will be a referendum in July on the agreement, and that if this referendum fails, then the Iraqi government will give notice, 1 year notice, for U.S. withdrawal. So that would have the effect of changing the withdrawal deadline that's in the agreement the parliament just passed to a withdrawal deadline of January 2010, essentially cutting it in half. And that would also broadly be consistent with the withdrawal deadline that President-elect Obama promised during the campaign of 16 months. So I think a very significant development in that the, as we saw through the negotiating process, the Iraqi government was able to stand its ground on several points and extract some real concessions from the Bush administration. It will be, we'll have to see, what will actually happen under this agreement. It was already reported, it was noted by McClatchy in the past few days, that the Bush administration and the Iraqi government have different interpretations of some of the key provisions. So, for example, one of the concessions that the Iraqi government was able to extract from the U.S. was wording forbidding U.S. actions from Iraqi territory against neighboring countries. It's now being suggested by Bush administration officials that there's a loophole that allows them to perhaps pursue insurgents into neighboring countries, as the U.S. Did in Syria shortly, just a couple weeks ago, which was one of the catalysts for the insertion of this provision. So there are some issues that remain to be resolved in practice in terms of the actual implementation of this agreement. Nonetheless, with the referendum provision, some of the critics of the accord have given the Iraqi electorate an opportunity to pass judgment on the U.S. Compliance. So they are going to, and of course now it's going to be the Obama administration, which one would hope perhaps introduce some different policies, perhaps less desire for confrontation with Iran and Syria. So combining all those elements, there's some reason to think that the U.S. may be held to the Iraqi version of the commitments that they've just signed.
And so one of the interesting things there being the fact that there will be a referendum in the middle of, probably the middle of 2009. Now, this is, of course, a situation where you have a referendum on a treaty which will already have come into effect, and which, because this treaty affects having U.S. troops in Iraq post January 1 of 2009. But presumably it would, in essence, be a plebiscite on the on how people feel that that agreement is being implemented.
Yes, and in fact, you know, perhaps this sets a good precedent for future international agreements, which often have different implementation and process than they are actually the basis of which they're sold at the time. Imagine if, for example, the North American Free Trade Agreement had been subject to a referendum after it had already gone into effect. I doubt that such a referendum would have passed in the United States, and one could think of other one can think of other examples. Often, many nasty things are revealed about the such agreements after they actually go into effect. So this really does. I think this is. I can't actually think of a historical precedent for a treaty being subject to a national referendum after it was implemented. But of course, it's not the if the referendum fails, it won't. Actually invalidate the treaty, the treaty will still be enforced. There's a provision in the treaty that, you know, people are talking about this allows U.S. troops to stay for 3 years till the end of 2011, and that's not technically correct. It sets a maximum of 3 years for the U.S. troops to remain, but it also says that either side can cancel the agreement, end the agreement with a year's notice. So what this referendum provision is saying is that if the referendum fails, then the Iraqi government must exercise its rights under the treaty to give 1 year notice for the U.S. troops to withdraw.
Okay, which would, of course, make the deadline be presumably sometime around the midpoint of 2010, which, as you noted earlier, would be in or around the 16-month period that Obama has has promised or has talked about during his election campaign.
Yes, although it should be noted that the withdrawal that would be prescribed in that case would actually be sharper than Obama indicated, because
Obama was talking about a drawdown rather than a full withdrawal.
Yeah, and leaving 30,000 to 40,000 residual troops of a residual force in the country. And this would be, at least as it's being talked about and described, this would be a complete withdrawal of United States forces.
Now, you mentioned another of the interesting facts here being just the extent to which there was such overwhelming agreement reached. Now, you indicated that this was the result of rather fervent negotiations and bargaining among the various different parties in order to make sure that could be reached, because there was a risk that it would not necessarily be signed and passed off by the government were it not to have that cross-party support in the parliament, but just the level the degree to which they reached agreement among the parties is noteworthy too, I think.
Yes, it's a good sign, and also there has been reporting over the course of the last week from different sources indicating that what was really at stake in the final days as they worked toward an agreement was not a debate over the actual provisions of the agreement itself, which actually had fairly broad support across the political class. People were happy that there was a firm deadline, or appeared to be a firm deadline for the withdrawal of U.S. troops, and that there were restrictions on the United States government that addressed several of the outstanding or sore issues, namely the U.S. Using Iraq to attack other countries, and the legal status of U.S. troops and contractors. The question of when the Iraqi legal system would have jurisdiction over crimes, and they got some real concessions there, that U.S. troops would be subject to Iraqi jurisdiction if they committed crimes when they were off base and off mission, and that contractors would be subject to Iraqi legal authority. And indeed, there's even seems to be some possibility that with respect to the contractors, that might be retroactive. So contractors could be held liable for crimes that they've committed in the past. So these provisions are quite popular, but with the exception of the Sadras, who object in principle to any agreement legitimizing from their point of view the continued presence of U.S. troops, what was really at stake, according to these reports, was concern about the Iraqi government and desire to get some, in Maliki in particular, what people perceive to be as a concentration of power there. And so people were looking for some concessions from the Iraqi government in order to pass the agreement, not because they objected to things in the agreement, but they didn't want, they saw this as a point of leverage on the Iraqi government.
Okay. One of the things you mentioned there, a point of contention, the Iraqi government throughout the negotiations, we've been hearing their concern that Iraq not be used as a staging post for attacks on other countries. And there have been, of course, a number of issues with Syria in the past. But one of the concerns that those in the U.S., I think, have been thinking about and wondering about was the possibility of Iraq being used as a staging post for an attack on Iran. Now, you mentioned an exception that the U.S. claim they see in it, which sounds to me to be a version of hot pursuit. Is that what they're claiming, that there's a hot pursuit exemption or exception in the treaty negotiated?
Yes, except that it's broader than. You know, these are, you know, reports of ambiguities described by U.S. officials, but what it seems that they're arguing is something more than hot pursuit. Hot pursuit, after all, is something that's in established international law. If you're, you know, if there is a guerrilla group makes a raid into your territory, and while you're engaged with them, they flee back across the border, you're allowed to follow. But what the U.S. wants... what it did when the U.S. did the strike in Syria, that was not hot pursuit. They were not chasing someone across the border during a firefight that started in Iraqi territory. They were doing something that was more like what Colombia did in the attack on Ecuador, attacking what they considered to be a base of attacks and Kurds coming across. And that's what they want to aim. So that's something, you know, beyond hot pursuit.
And something that becomes incredibly murky in terms of the definitions. We believe that this base is being used for attacks which we believe are caused by this party. It's perhaps more prone to misuse than would be the case with hot pursuit alone.
Well, indeed, absolutely. And the other key question here going forward after January 1 is what the position of the Iraq government is. You know, the Iraqi government has good relations, is trying to maintain good relations with Syria, and the Iraqi government has very good relations with the Iranian government. So if it's true, as other provisions of this agreement indicate, that the Iraqi government has say-so over such operations, presumably the Iraqi government will not approve them. And if they did, if such actions did take place, you know, these other countries would hold the Iraqi government responsible. So they would be caught between a rock and a hard place. Either they would have to say, well, this is not our fault because we didn't approve them, would put them in trouble with their own population, having claimed that they would have such power under an agreement, or they have to say that they did approve it, which puts them in hot water with the neighboring
with their big
countries.
Neighbor. Yep. Yeah. Moving on perhaps from Iraq, if we may, and to one of those neighboring countries, Iran, there have been renewed calls this week for... the U.S. to engage in diplomacy with Iran, and this was an issue that that came up, of course, during the presidential campaign. Obama had indicated that he would be open to direct negotiations, to direct talks with Iran. Though still perhaps more of a hardline stance than some might like, as he backed off from that initial position. What are the nature of the calls that are coming out this week, and how significant are they, do you think?
Well, let me say that as far as I'm aware, and as you know, I follow this issue fairly closely, Obama had never backed off on the fundamental point of negotiating, engaging with Iran diplomatically without preconditions. There may have been some shift in rhetoric. You know, it may have gone become more harsh as the campaign progressed. He may have pivoted on this other related but distinct question about, and I would argue and have argued, less important question about how that takes place. Is it at the presidential level, is it at the Secretary of State level, whatever, which I think is less important. I'm happy personally actually to let the Obama people figure out the logistics of that. But the fundamental question of engaging Iran diplomatically without preconditions, as far as I'm aware, they've never backed off on that. And in fact, this week there was pretty good indication. Of course, the question on the minds of many is, in general, now the campaign is over, Obama promised change, what's really going to happen? People are seeing appointments that look like the same old cast of characters, the third Clinton administration. So people want to know what's really going to happen. But at least at the level of policy with respect to this question, indications are that the Obama people will move forward. So here's some data. First of all, what are the recent signs? There was a very interesting article yesterday in the Washington Times that indicated that recently top Israeli officials have been indicating their openness to a U.S. approach to diplomacy with Iran. This is striking because Israeli officials had been the most ardent in cautioning against. As lately as a few weeks ago, Israel's foreign minister, Livni, now a candidate for prime minister, had cautioned Obama about moving too quickly towards negotiations with Iran. The Israeli government has been constantly pushing the U.S. for an aggressive posture. Now, the Washington Times reports, top Israeli officials, the top military intelligence official, quoted as saying, well, it might not be so bad if there's a U.S. opening to diplomacy with Iran. This could actually be useful addressing the issue of Iran's nuclear program. Well, this is a strong, in the analysis of the Washington Times piece and some of the people that they talked to in Israel, the reason that they gave for this was, well, people see that this is the way that Obama's going, and they don't want to be, like the train's leaving the station and they want to be on it. They don't want to be perceived as the spoilers, the skunks at the party, and so they're going to try and work with this. Well, that's a very powerful indication. If to me at least, if the top people in the Israeli government, government circles, have made a decision that they're going to, play along with this Obama diplomatic initiative because they perceive it as a done deal, then that's strong evidence that it's a done deal. I mean, the very people that were, pushing in the opposite direction, are now decided to go along with this. So that's a positive indication. There have been other positive.
I was going to say, it seems either way, if they're doing it because they believe it to be a done deal, that's a good sign insofar as presumably they would be rather cautious on that. If they're doing it while not feeling that it's a done deal, that would again seem to be a positive indication insofar as you are getting new people on board pushing in this direction.
Absolutely. And the Israelis have the same largely the same information set that we do. It's not completely illogical that they would come to similar conclusions. The smart people in Israel know that they likely don't have the capacity to do anything productive with the military strike. They know that the negative consequences of military strike are hard to predict, that it would have negative impact on their ally, the United States, and that any diplomatic initiative is going to require international cooperation, and that the incoming Obama administration is going to have some political capital to deploy with other countries in seek of concerted diplomatic effort to resolve the conflict. So it's a natural, it's not a completely bizarre thing for them to articulate, in addition to the fact that, you know, that's also plausible that they're just getting on the train that's leaving the station.
But, and you mentioned in any other event, people?
Definitely a good sign. Yeah, so the since Obama's election, there's been a renewed call from Javier Solana, who's the top European Union foreign policy official who's led the European talks with Iran on the nuclear program, called, as the Europeans have long called for, maybe more quietly, for the U.S. to be more deeply engaged in the multilateral diplomatic process. So essentially calling on the incoming Obama administration to do exactly that which they've promised that they would do. So it's sort of a helpful lobbying of the incoming Obama administration. Also, in the last few weeks, there was a panel of experts, of foreign policy luminaries, led by former Ambassador Pickering and former Ambassador Dobbins, released a statement calling on the United States to engage in direct, sustained, comprehensive bilateral negotiations with Iran in all issues in dispute. All these things are, I think, contributing to a positive perception that this is definitely the direction in which the Obama administration will move. The mechanics, the logistics, the pace, this remains to be seen. Certainly, there are upcoming elections in Iran, presidential elections in Iran, which in general would tend to cool the ardor of anyone to move at too high a level or too aggressively too quickly. You don't want to. There's lots of reasons for not wanting to get entangled in the Iranian election process. But what many are calling for is saying, you know, there are issues on which the United States could move immediately with respect to Iran at a lower level. There's common interests in Iraq. There's common interests in Afghanistan. We could move on these issues and thereby establish, you know, better relationship and confidence as we collaborate things that, in fact, we agree on anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your comments on the upcoming election are interesting. One of the questions I was going to ask was whether or not you've any sense of how or whether what sort of response there is within Iran or from Iran to the possibility of a more proactive or a more diplomacy-based approach from the new administration.
Well, first, speaking of public opinion, the press reports indicate that there's a significant degree of optimism among Iranians that the incoming Obama administration would potentially represent a change of policy towards more engagement with the negotiations with the Iranian government, you know, cooling of tensions, and better relations. With respect to Iranian officials, there have been some positive signals and some negative signals. Perhaps not surprisingly, because there have been positive signals and negative signals from the United States. So for example, President Ahmadinejad sent President-elect Obama a letter of congratulations, which is something unprecedented in the recent history between the two countries. Not since 1979 has the President of Iran sent an incoming President of the United States a letter of congratulations. Then Obama was asked about this at a press conference, and he gave a kind of prickly response, sort of echoed the existing rhetoric of the administration, saying, was somewhat cautious, and he said, I'm not going to respond to this in a knee-jerk way. I will study this and give an appropriate response. Paraphrase, we're not going to tolerate Iranian support of terrorism, and we're not going to tolerate an Iranian nuclear weapon. So these comments appeared to many in Iran to echo the existing rhetoric of the Bush administration, and they provoked a hostile Iranian response. nonetheless, there have been other indications since the election of positive comments from the Iranian leaders, Foreign Minister Mottaki, that indicate an openness to starting afresh with the incoming Obama administration. It's well known in Tehran, as it is in Washington, that there are common interests with the United States. There, people are very aware that the U.S. Removed the two historic adversaries, the Saddam Hussein government in Iraq and the Taliban government in Afghanistan. In fact, Iran cooperated with the U.S. in the Afghanistan project. So they're aware that there are common interests, and they're aware that there are people in the Obama orbit who have seriously advocated for a different U.S. policy on the nuclear question. So, for example, Joseph Chironcioni, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund, a disarmament nonprofit, disarmament nonproliferation nonprofit, is in the circle of extended circle of Obama advisors, which is, you know, is a huge set of people that spans a lot of political territory. But he's been involved in this kind of civil society dialogue efforts between the U.S. and Iran, and in particular in the efforts of Ambassador Pickering to construct a framework for U.S. negotiation with Iran that would result in something that would, on the one hand, address U.S. concerns about future military component of an Iranian nuclear program, while addressing the Iranians' demand that they have the ability to enrich uranium in Iran. And in particular, Pickering has called for a multinational, international consortium to enrich uranium in Iran in order to meet these two concerns. So they're aware that these things are in the mix, and in fact, the Iranian government in its May letter to the United Nations explicitly mentioned this proposal for multilateral enrichment in Iran is something that they're willing to negotiate on. So there's definitely room there. Everybody in Washington and Tehran who wants to know this knows that there is potentially space there for negotiation on these issues.
It struck me when you mentioned the initial Obama press conference. I think it was the Friday, perhaps, after the election, so that would be the 7th November press conference. What seemed to me to be the dominant theme at that was Obama trying to enunciate the point that he was not yet president, the Bush administration was still in charge of the U.S., and that he would be cooperating in an orderly transition, just as the outgoing president must cooperate in handing over power, that Obama would not be interfering with U.S. policy until he became president. It seems to me perhaps that that there was a good degree of caution at that point, that but that the Obama transition team and Obama himself may be becoming perhaps more confident in striking out a different path as time goes on. So I wonder if that might be part of the kind of the calculus that Obama was undertaking in wording his response at that point in time.
Well, the overall statement is true. It's sort of undeniable and indisputable. He's not the president of the United States. He has no formal power. And it would be typical in this period for Obama to say something like that. You know, people are trying to get him to respond to things, and for him to say, look, I'm not the president. So I'm not sure one can read too much into that. It's also true that, you know, until this week, we haven't seen, you know, it's pretty clear the direction things are going, but there hasn't been a formal announcement of Obama's foreign policy team. So it's still early days. I don't think that they're going to announce, it's reasonable for them to announce any particular initiative till Obama's in the White House. But as far as I can tell, there's no break. There's no substantial break in the in their line that they've advocated on renewed diplomacy.
Mm-hmm. If I may transition a little bit to one of the things that discussion raises is there's been a good bit of to and fro, both online and elsewhere, analyzing to death the various different appointments that Obama has made, is rumored to be mulling over, and so on, in relation both to first foreign policy, diplomacy, and the broad external set of appointments, and also in relation to his economic appointments. First, in relation to the foreign policy appointments, last week we talked about the potential appointment of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. Now, that is still not yet a done deal, though the rumors that are being leaked by whomever indicate that it is getting closer by the day, with an announcement expected from Obama shortly after Thanksgiving. What other appointments, or how do you view the totality of other appointments in this sphere that Obama has been making so far?
Well, it's the overall pattern is quite clear. We're not seeing yet any really new faces. The people that we're seeing are generally people that served in some role in the Clinton administration. People are saying that this means that this is Obama's third term, and he's answering that with some justification, that it's always the case that incoming administration turned back to people that served the same party in the previous administration. So nonetheless, of course, within that, one can make distinctions. So, for example, with respect to the position of Secretary of State, he had other choices. He could have chosen, for example, New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson. That would have also been someone who had served in the Clinton administration. Richardson was Ambassador to the United Nations, Secretary of Energy. But it would have sent somewhat different signal than the appointment of Hillary Clinton. So even choosing people with that kind of experience doesn't mean that you still don't make choices. He's saying, well, this also doesn't mean that I'm not going to pursue different policies. It's me. I set the policies, and these people implement the policies. And that's true, too. We won't really be able to say there isn't anything they've done yet that really tips their hand. Mm-hmm. We'll see soon enough whether there is the actual policy change that's been promised.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to give the quote from Obama, from Wednesday's press conference, understand where the vision for change comes from first and foremost. It comes from me. That's my job, to provide a vision in terms of where we are going and to make sure that my team is implementing it. And this followed on from, as you said, explaining that had he not picked people who had experience in administration, that he would be accused of being naive in terms of appointing people who would not actually be capable of getting work done because of lack of experience of how Washington worked and of administration. And so, given that there are few people who have Carter administration experience, but not Clinton experience, and who would be still looking to get involved in the Obama administration, that there was essentially little choice for a Democratic president but to have people with Clinton-era experience.
Yeah, so as I said, I mean, the points that he made are fair points, but within the within that set of people, there's a range. You know, there were some progressive people that served in the Clinton administration. I haven't heard Robert Reich's name come up recently, but he was Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration, and is generally considered and is a progressive voice. So it doesn't completely answer the objection, although it does to some degree. With respect to the economic appointments, I mean, there we're definitely seeing the same gang coming back in slightly different form. Larry Summers' name was floated as Secretary of the Treasury, he, of course, was Secretary of the Treasury under Clinton. Now, he's not going to be Secretary of the Treasury. For that, they're appointing Tim Geithner, now the head of the New York Fed, but part of an undersecretary of Treasury under Clinton. So not a new face, but somebody that most people don't know and doesn't have the baggage the political baggage that Larry Summers has, but definitely doesn't indicate any change in policy, even from the Bush administration. After all, you know, one of the top things people are thinking about with respect to the economy is the state of play of the Wall Street bailout. Well, that's something that Geithner has been intimately involved in his position at the New York Fed. And arguably, that's why he's been by the Obama administration to send a signal to the markets of continuity rather than change. So certainly nothing to be happy about in Geithner's appointment, except maybe if you wanted to find something to be happy about, it would be the fact that it does perhaps represent some victory of pressure, because a lot of people were upset about the idea of Larry Summers being appointed as Treasury Secretary, not just because of his association with policy failures of the past, like the deregulation of the financial markets under the Clinton administration, but in particular some of the very controversial statements of his past. His statement while as president of Harvard that, you know, we can look, we're looking for an explanation of why there aren't women in top positions in math and science at universities. Maybe it's because their brains are different. That caused a storm. And also when he was, this is perhaps a little more forgotten, but at the time more notorious, when he was chief economist at the World Bank, he wrote this infamous memo, internal but circular, but became public, arguing that Africa is underpolluted and that the World Bank should be promoting the transfer of heavy polluting industry to Africa. With respect to his statements as president of Harvard about women in math and science, this caused, not surprisingly, a great deal of outrage among women's groups. And in the past several weeks, when his name was being floated as Treasury Secretary, many folks were writing and lobbying the Obama administration not to appoint him, including the National Organization for Women. Well, what they said was, in the press reports, is we're not lobbying for Summers not to be appointed. We're sharing with the Obama administration prominent women who would be, you know, well qualified to be Treasury Secretary. But nonetheless, it was reported that they were lobbying against Summers' appointment. So you can say, and some people credited that with keeping him out of consideration for the position of Treasury Secretary. And so maybe that's a victory for the activist groups that were saying, you know, this is politically, this is bad for Larry Summers after his track record to be rewarded with this prestigious slot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's that. One of the interesting things that's difficult for somebody like myself who doesn't have direct knowledge of these things. Summers now, not Treasury Secretary, but Director of the National Economic Council. Now, this is one of several different councils dealing with economic issues. There's the Council of Economic Advisers, there's the Domestic Policy Council, and then there's this National Economic Council. Just how is this shunting him to one side with a kind of a we want to recognize your contribution but put you in a position where you can't do damage, essentially, or will he actually have real impact on policy issues?
Well, there's no way to really completely answer that question, because it will be up to the president. He will definitely he's going to have influence. There's no question about that.
And perhaps as an advisor, even without a formal appointment.
And indeed, without even a formal appointment, it's up to. I mean, who has influence is up to Obama. And these, if you look back through past administrations, the people in these slots have had different levels of influence in different administrations. A key difference between the appointment that was announced and the position of Treasury Secretary is that the Treasury Secretary has to be confirmed by the Senate. So that would have been an opportunity for people to ask embarrassing questions about Larry Summers' past. Tim Geithner doesn't have that kind of past. I mean, the most provocative things that most people know about and understand, like the comment about women in math and science or the memo at the World Bank, those Geithner doesn't have those kinds of things. Geithner was involved in, you know, he's involved in the current bailout. He was involved in the, he was in the Clinton's Treasury Department during the International Monetary Fund and the Asian financial crisis and during the domestic deregulation. So he was been involved in all this stuff too, but not in, you know, in the high profile way, and not these, you know, really provocative things that most people know about. So you could say, you know, likely to have a much smoother confirmation hearing in the Senate than Larry Summers may have had. But Larry Summers is definitely going to have influence in the Obama administration in this position. How much is, you know, in the mix of people saying different things, how much he'll have is impossible to say, because that's up to Obama going forward.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that Obama has done is to announce the creation. I mentioned there are, you know, there are several different councils that provide advice to the president, and as you say, the extent to which they have influence depends on exactly what the president chooses to do with that advice. But Obama has announced the creation of a new council or a new board called the President's Economic Recovery Advisory Board, a temporary board to run for at least 2 years. And he's modeling it, he says, on Eisenhower's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board to provide advice from outside the Beltway, from outside Washington, to the president. Now, presumably, it's unclear to me to what extent, you know, or how you would create a clear line there. The only two appointments announced so far for that are Paul Volcker, former Fed Reserve Chair, as chairman of the panel, and University of Chicago economist, Austin Goolsbee, as the staff director and chief economist. Now, we don't yet know who else is going to be on that, but given Volcker and Goolsbee as the initial members, what would be your judgment of those two and of the prospects for contrary minded advice?
Well, again, hard to say. Historically, Volcker played, when he was chair of the Fed, he was appointed by Carter, instituted a very harsh austerity program, jacking up interest rates late in the Carter administration in a brutal effort to suppress inflation. So that wouldn't...
I was going to say, all other things being equal, suppressing inflation has the impact of increasing unemployment, or rather, you choose an emphasis either on interest rates or unemployment with any individual policy activity. So it shows a certain preference there.
Absolutely. And he in his stewardship marked a sharp break towards a dramatic shift towards privileging, you know, saying it's more important to contain inflation than to contain unemployment. Obviously that hurt a lot of people, and also hurt Carter because essentially caused a recession just as Carter was running for re-election in 1980. So that wouldn't that part wouldn't be encouraging. On the other hand, Obama has come out four square for a major economic stimulus package, much more ambitious than what's been contemplated in the current administration. And arguably, this is the most, far and away, the most decisive economic policy issue at the moment. You know, we're entering a severe recession as a result of the collapse of the housing bubble and the financial crisis. And so arguably the most important question on the domestic policy front that Obama faces on January 20th is how big and how fast an economic stimulus package. And so far, the indications coming out of him is that very big and very fast, and at least in the short term, never mind about the deficit. So that's very positive. Volker's presence on the scene doesn't seem to be interfering with that at all.
Okay, and of course Obama has not yet named the other members of the team, and there are a range of progressive and independent minded economists who we have not seen appointed to Treasury or to core positions in the team, but who might find a place in this outside the Beltway advisory model.
Yeah, it seems to actually be a pattern. If we sort of predict based on the past, recent past with Obama, the pattern would seem to indicate that we will not see I don't expect to see any progressives in the major appointments in the administration. Maybe, at Labor or Health or Human Services, mm-hmm. or at the Environmental Protection Agency, at OSHA, we'll see some more progressive people. And that's kind of typical for, you know, a center-left administration. I mean, Clinton, you know, you had Rubin at Treasury and Robert Reich at Labor. But we won't see I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see any real progressives in major slots, but we will see them perhaps in these broader advisory groups. Part of Obama's strategy has been to create these sort of large advisory committees on particular issues that actually have a substantial range of opinion. So, for example, he created an Iraq advisory group with a bunch of luminaries. Arguably, his own opinion was in a minority on his advisory committee. Like, if he had been a member of his own advisory committee, he would have been in the left minority. The chair of his advisory committee on Iraq was someone who basically had something very close to the Bush administration's policy on what should be done in Iraq. And then he had other people on the committee, like from the Center for American Progress, who were arguing for a firm timetable for withdrawal, aggressive diplomacy to bring that about. So I wouldn't be surprised at all. I mean, someone like Dean Baker, for example, is serving as an unofficial advisor to the Obama transition team. So actual progressive economists are in the mix, but I don't expect to see them as actual appointments in the administration.
Okay. And of course, that provides an interesting dynamic. I'm thinking here of when AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Trumka was in Urbana about a month or so before the election, and his claim in response to a question about the shape of the post-election administration was that the AFL-CIO would be pushing for Labour-friendly appointments in positions other than the Secretary of Labour, insofar as Labour, to a large extent, is stuck implementing policy which is decided kind of upstream of that. The AFL-CIO may not be successful in that sort of upstream policy making appointment, but may get more people in the mix in terms of the discussions that go on prior to or around deciding the broad shape of policy.
Yeah, I'm not inside these negotiations and dynamics, obviously, sure. But I don't expect them to have much influence at all at Treasury or Commerce in the appointments. Much more influence at Labor. Mine Safety Administration, OSHA, the National Labor Relations Board, and these are also, incredibly powerful posts that have dramatic impact over the quality of workers' lives. You know, and during the Bush administration, we've seen appointments of people that don't even believe in enforcing the law. I mean, these are matters like mine safety, OSHA. These are matters of life and death. At the NLRB, I mean, something sort of close to home, under the Clinton administration, there was a ruling that mandated that private teaching assistants in the private sector, at least some private sector institutions, had a right to organize. The Bush administration, NLRB, overturned that, and the administration at New York University moved immediately to bust the teaching assistants union at NYU, which they did successfully. Well, they were only able to do that because of the Bush administration NLRB. So, and there have been other NLRB decisions under the Bush administration that restricted the rights of workers to organize. So those are extremely, important appointments. And I definitely expect that labor will have significant influence over them, and that we'll see. I mean, even under the Clinton administration, we saw appointments in those positions of people who at least believed in enforcing the law. And Robert Reich, when he was labor secretary, did intervene in some of the labor disputes, and sometimes intervene against, negative interventions that were sought by employers. So those appointments do matter, even if they're not as, it would be great if they would have a greater influence in who was appointed a treasurer. Also, they are going to have influence in the coming debate over the economic stimulus, which is tremendously important. For determine how many people are going to be unemployed in the United States in the middle of next year, the size of this economic stimulus package, the shape of it, is going to have a decisive influence.
Mm-hmm. Bob, we're coming up towards the last few minutes in the show. For those who are listening and wondering, in the week to come, what stories there's obviously a huge amount that we haven't got to cover today. What should people continue to watch, do you think, as a key stories, key developing stories that will have an impact on the world around us?
Well, we'll see. Once the appointment of Secretary of State is made, we'll see some lower level appointments in the foreign policy bureaucracy. And that'll give some indication, imperfect, of what's ahead. Will Dennis Ross come back to play a role in U.S. policy towards Iran or Israeli-Palestinian negotiations? There have been calls for a new policy with respect to Latin America, including a recent Brookings study with foreign policy luminaries that goes beyond the relaxation of the Cuba embargo that Obama promised in the campaign, calling for free travel for all Americans to Cuba, not just Cuban Americans with families in Cuba. So that will be an interesting development. There seems to be some possibility of movement there. Bolivia is going to have an election on January 25th, a referendum on their proposed new constitution. This would be a very significant development in the history of the region. This constitution enshrines new rights for the indigenous population of Bolivia, bans the privatization of water, and there's a lot of progressive provisions. So we're at a moment now where relations between the U.S. and Bolivia are in a very negative place. There was a recall of ambassadors. The Bush administration announced the suspension of Bolivia's benefits under the Andean Trade Agreement. There's definitely a possibility of movement in the Obama administration, and we don't have any good indications yet of what's coming, but that's something to look towards the coming weeks.
Bob, thank you very much for joining us, and thank you to our listeners for listening. You're listening to WRFU LP Urbana. This is a Critical Ear weekly show, bringing you a roundup of news on U.S. foreign policy, labor matters, and much more. Saturday, December 6th, just over a week from now, there's a WRFU benefit show at the Cowboy Monkey, 6 p.m. until 2 a.m., just $4 to get in. Please do turn out for that. Support WRFU and our plan to raise a new permanent tower for WRFU so we can better serve our community. Thank you again for listening, and do join us this time next week.